Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. For today's show, we're straying away from the current affairs scope this show usually limits itself to, and heading back in time to the scene of a Salt Lake City murder mystery. In the early morning hours of January 27th, 1915, 54-year-old Olivia Cooper was doing what she had been doing nearly every day for the past 6 months. Olivia ran a boarding house, the Ramona, on 200 South, just below 200 East in Salt Lake City. But to make a little extra money, she had taken a second job as a cleaner, scrubbing and polishing the surfaces, fixtures, display cases, and floors of Franklin's Cafe in downtown Salt Lake City. Franklin's was part soda shop, part diner, and part ice cream parlor. It was located on Salt Lake's Main Street between 2nd and 3rd South, and it was a popular spot for downtown workers, churchgoers, the after-school crowd, and anyone who liked a snack. Olivia's husband was away on a mission for the Mormon Church in India, and having an extra source of income beyond the boarding house was something she couldn't pass up. But it meant getting up very early, earlier even than she normally got up to deal with the boarders she attended on a daily basis. And so that morning, January 27th, 1915, a Wednesday morning, Olivia was there in J.H. Franklin's cafe, mopping and scrubbing and polishing, when a thief, or maybe thieves, broke in, hoping to score some cash from the till, and probably not expecting such early morning, or late night, depending on how you see it, company. Maybe she screamed. Maybe she tried to intervene. Maybe she was just in the way. Whatever the case, Olivia Cooper died that morning. The cause of death, a blow to the head with a heavy object. She was killed almost instantly. I'm going to sum up the next part because it's predictable for a murder mystery. The police tried and failed to find a suspect in the murder. Actually, they arrested a man, the man who alerted police to the body in the first place. Charles Radovich, a cleaner himself at the neighboring Mahezy Theater, was brought to the scene of the crime, or so he said, by a newsboy, another early morning denizen of Salt Lake's Main Street in those days. Radovich said that the boy, getting ready to deliver news to the yet-to-arrive downtown crowds, had stumbled across some news of his own. Through the window of Franklin's shop, he saw Olivia's body sprawled out across the floor. Radovich happened to be on the street at the time, and the boy alerted the man, who alerted the police, who later arrested him. But eventually, they had to let him go, because there wasn't enough evidence to link him to the crime. Detectives investigating the case didn't have all that much to go on, just a boot print on a piece of furniture, and the fact that the door wasn't forced. But then, maybe it wasn't even locked. They offered a $500 reward for information that would help catch Olivia's killer, but that came to nothing. And so, and really everything I've been saying up till now has been prelude to that and so they turned to the cutting-edge science of the day. They held open Olivia Cooper's lifeless eyes and took pictures of her retinas in the hopes of getting an image of the killer. I know, that sounds nuts, but it's true. Here's an excerpt of the Salt Lake Telegram's account of this technique being employed back in 1915.
Thwarted at every turn in the search for a tangible clue that might lead to the identity of the murderer of Mrs. Olivia Cooper in J.H.R. Franklin's store early yesterday morning, Inspector of Police C.A. Carlson this afternoon had photographed with high-powered lenses the retina of each eye of the murdered woman. The possibility of the image of her assailant being transferred into a photograph and thus uncovering the identity of the murderer prompted Inspector Carlson to have the eyes photographed. He said he had heard that the test had been successful in Europe and had been tried in the East.
C.E. Johnson, the photographer brought in for the specialized job, shone a bright light in the dead woman's eyes, and making use of what the newspaper reports called a specially prepared high-powered lens, took three separate pictures with very long exposures, 3 minutes per shot. Alas,
this first trial ever made in Utah was done under unfavorable conditions, declared Mr. Johnson and Inspector Carlson. The body had been embalmed and chemical fluids injected into the tissues. While it is not known, it is believed that this would spoil the image supposed to be held in the eye of the last thing seen before death. The image Mrs. Cooper would have held after death, the police declare, would be that of her murderer, as she was evidently facing and struggling with him when the death blow was struck.
The concept that is the basis for this theory of crime solving is called optography, and it stems from something that you yourself have likely experienced. Stare at an object for a while, and then look at a blank page or a white wall, or simply close your eyes, and you'll continue seeing that object as a kind of outline. In fact, in 1854, an English scientist soberly carried out that experiment. For his groundbreaking test, the Reverend William Scoresley would stare intently at an object, and then he'd close his eyes and count how long the image would linger. Then he would repeat the process with a different object. Scoresley reported his findings to the 24th meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, held that year in Liverpool. His study was called On Pictorial and Photochromatic Impressions on the Retina of the Human Eye. Unfortunately, the exact number of seconds objects like the moon, the sun, an orange, or a yellow wafer would remain imprinted on the retina is, as best I can tell, lost to history. However, from a summary of Scoresley's presentation to the British scientists assembled in Liverpool, we do know that the effect could be extended for a much longer period of time by blinking a lot. But how did we get from that experiment to the idea that the last thing you see at the moment of your death will be fixed on your retina?
There was a German anatomist by the name of Franz Boll who noticed that his frogs, I think it was, the frog retinas would bleach out from a beautiful red color to a completely clear piece of tissue when the frog died.
That's Simon Ings, author of the book A Natural History of Seeing.
But he noticed that if he kept his dead frogs, we're talking 19th century, if he kept his dead frogs in the dark, then their retinas, the tissue at the back of the eye, would remain in a beautiful red color for about 24 hours. So there was clearly some kind of chemical process going on in the eye that had nothing to do with life or death necessarily, but was a simple reaction to the presence of light. And so he figured, well, whatever chemical is on this tissue or in this tissue, this must be something to do with vision.
Frog retinas were just the start. Picking up where Franz Boll left off with frogs, another German researcher named Wilhelm Kühne began experimenting with rabbits, with remarkable results. Again, Simon Ings.
You know what? He actually had a fair bit of success. There is a perfectly good optogram, which is the last thing that one of his experimental rabbits managed to see. And it's a picture of a window, and you can see the sunlight streaming through the window.
We should mention here that the way that image was obtained was under extremely specific circumstances. A rabbit's head was immobilized, facing the window in question. Then Kühne would put a cloth hood over the animal's head for a time to block out the light. Finally, he'd remove the hood and expose the eyes to the window for 3 minutes before the rabbit was decapitated and the eyes removed and dissected and the retinas soaked in an alum solution, essentially fixing the image of the window. It was astonishing. Kühne had turned rabbits, or at least their eyes, into cameras.
The problem, of course, is when you try and do the same trick with people, because people's eyes are really odd. They're more like birds' eyes than mammalian eyes. They focus everything to this incredibly tight point.
Optography for forensic investigation was, and remains, just a myth, the stuff of fiction. But murder cases where optography was used keep turning up as late as the 1920s. This despite near constant refutations in newspapers and journals by other forensic researchers, and no instances of successful evidence gathering using the method. Still, the technique was used to produce results in other ways.
It was. There's a chap called Fritz Angerstein, a maniac, who the German police were absolutely convinced had hacked to death his family and his gardener and his housekeeper, 8 people in all, to death with a hatchet. And in order to speed up the inquiry, they presented Angerstein with a formal document saying, "We have an image from your gardener's eye. And what it shows is the identity of the person wielding the hatchet, delivering the death blow. And Angerstein, within about 2 minutes, rolls over and confesses to the crime and is banged up. And this is in July 1925. Needless to say, the photograph was never made public and was presumably just a story made up by the investigating officers to demoralize the defendant.
It's worth noting here that in its early days, the strange, almost terrifying otherworldliness of photography meant that the technology was prone to, let's say, artful appropriation by people whose purpose tended to the pseudoscientific or even the mystical. In fact, even Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of that most famous evidence-driven detective of all time, Sherlock Holmes, even Conan Doyle took photography into areas that stretched the boundaries of the rational. Which, in a way, brings us back to where we started, to Utah. In a visit to Salt Lake City in 1923, Doyle gave a presentation inside the Mormon Tabernacle. His lecture had to do with spiritualism, and he made use of photography to drive his point home. Here's Doyle scholar Michael Homer describing the famous author's stop in Salt Lake in 1923, just 8 years after the murder of Olivia Cooper and the attempted use of forensic optography by Salt Lake detectives.
As part of his second American tour, he visited Salt Lake City and was invited to give a presentation in the tabernacle where he showed slides of spirit photography, among other things. And 5,000 people attended that presentation. There was a lot of good press on it, not a lot of negative press at all, mainly because he was recognized as obviously a world-famous author, but also because he was becoming well-known at that time as a proponent of spiritualism. So he tried to convince the crowd that the spirit photography and other what he considered to be physical manifestations of the spirit world through spiritualism mediums was a proof of an afterlife that men and women could hang on to as opposed to believing in dogma or unprovable conclusions.
Here's the creator of the detective who employs something called the science of deduction in his crime solving, arguing for direct communication with the spirit world, with the dead.
I'm always asked, how could someone who created the master machine thinker, Sherlock Holmes, ever believe in spiritualism? But I think it's obvious. He grew up Catholic, and he complained that he had hammered into him dogma that you have to believe even though there's no proof of things. And he viewed spiritualism as the answer to understanding and proving the afterlife, because he really thought that the spirit photographs, the ectoplasm, the automatic writing, and table turning, all the things that make up spiritualism, really proved once and for all that there was an afterlife.
Which is to say that Doyle wasn't being un-Sherlockian about his spiritualism. Like the detective taking pictures of murder victims' retinas, Doyle was applying what he thought was cutting-edge science to answer previously unanswerable questions. But what was once cutting edge is now the discarded stuff of pseudoscience. According to Simon Ings, to a certain extent, it's our perspective, the distance in time, that makes these historical practices as laughable as they might seem today.
We have to be careful not to poo-poo some of these ideas around spirituality, because quite often they turn out to be predicated on real scientific discoveries of the day. And of course, when you find something new, you have to push it in every possible direction to know what shape it's taking.
Part of that pushing included photographing the eyes of a 54-year-old Salt Lake City woman more than a century ago in a futile attempt to find her killer. That case remains unsolved. But all of this begs the question, is there a modern-day analog, a technique that we're using today that 100 years from now will be viewed the same way that we now see forensic optography?
I reckon that a lot of the work we are doing in scanning the brain and looking for what different areas of the brain actually do is going to be laughed out of the ballpark within 10, 15 years. And that's not because the researchers aren't aware of the problems around the questions they're asking. It's not because people aren't smart around this stuff. It's that the possibilities of this technology are so huge and so ill-defined that every researcher who's putting volunteers through a PET scanner and seeing how their brains react to certain situations and looking for the center for violence or the center for memory and all the rest of it, they're asking so many complex and slightly diffuse questions that a lot of them will in the end be thrown out. Inevitably, there's going to come the moment where you'll want to put a suspect in a brain scanner to see if they have the memory of a crime. It's such an obvious idea. Eventually, we'll get to the point where that seems like a reasonable thing to do. And 10 years after that, we'll look at that experiment and go, yeah, this is a bit like a drunk looking for their car keys under the street lamp, because that's where the light is. You know, it's one of those questions that has its own answer built in. It's too narrow. The more we know, the more we'll realize that that's the wrong question to ask.
Thanks to Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby, who told me about the case of Olivia Cooper a couple of years back, to researcher and author Simon Ings, and to my sister, Molly Murray, for her dramatic readings of old newspaper text. For the remainder of the show, we'll come back to the present day for a look at a more modern and far more effective crime-solving tool, the gathering and processing of genetic evidence. Actually, in most cases, DNA is simply additional evidence for investigators in criminal cases that they are already well on their way to solving. A strand of hair, fluid, blood left behind at a crime scene, DNA can be a way to more conclusively tie a suspect to the wrongdoing they are accused of. Or, alternatively, it can be used to call into question a person's involvement in a crime, or even exonerate them. In some instances, though, the processing of DNA can help generate new leads in cases that have gone cold. But first, that testing has to actually happen. Maybe you've heard about the backlog of evidence testing at crime labs in Utah. Police say some evidence can take months or even years to process, and that sometimes the cost of getting evidence tested at private labs is simply too high, especially for smaller police departments. Well, one local organization wants to offer a solution to that backlog. The Utah Cold Case Coalition plans to launch its own crime lab to test DNA, in fact, the first nonprofit crime lab in the country. Yesterday, I spoke with the organization's co-founder, Kara Porter, to learn more. Before we turn to a new initiative on DNA testing on the crime lab that you guys are trying to launch, who is the Utah Cold Case Coalition, Kara?
We were originally founded by three people. Jason Jensen, who's a private investigator, Tom Harvey, who was a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune for 25 years, yeah. And me, an attorney. And we originally formed because we were contacted by a family that was in need, and we kind of took it from there.
That included getting a new law passed, or a law passed last year in 2018, that creates a statewide database of cold cases, right?
Yes, that was one of the first things that we did. When we were trying to help this family, the first thing that we did was try to sit down and see whether there had been any similar murders. And we very quickly realized there was no way to know that because there was no database. A lot of cities and counties didn't have any website or anything that listed their cold cases. I mean, Sherry Black, who was one of the most high-profile cold cases, was not on anybody's website as a cold case. And so we wanted to fix that.
In addition to that database, you also offer rewards for information related to these cold cases. How does that work?
We are offering a $3,000 reward for information that leads to solving a case. And that can even be if the person's dead or can't be prosecuted for some reason. As long as we're satisfied that it's been solved, we'll pay that reward. Utah is the only state in the country that is offering a reward on every single cold case.
How many cold cases are there in Utah?
There's between 300 and 400.
Wow. Well, let's turn to this new initiative. It's a relatively new initiative of the Utah Cold Case Coalition. Your organization is working to launch a DNA testing lab. This would be the first lab of its kind in the country operated by a nonprofit organization, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
Why is the Utah Cold Case Coalition doing this?
One of the things that we noticed when we were looking at cold case files was that in a number of cases, there was evidence that looked like it could be tested for DNA. And sometimes there were explicit references in the file. There is DNA here. You could have it tested. But I also kept hearing from law enforcement, hey, we would love to, budget problems. DNA labs are either maybe the state crime lab, for example, is backed up, or it will refuse to test certain items. Or if it goes to a private lab, the expense is just really, really high. So we kept hearing those kinds of things over and over again. I even heard it from out-of-state law enforcement that said it took years to come up with enough money in the budget to get some DNA testing. These officers and detectives, they want these cases solved. But if it's going to cost them, let's say the first round of DNA testing, let's say is $3,000 or $4,000, and then that doesn't do it, so there's another type of testing, and that's another $4,000 or $5,000. To any police budget, that's a huge hit. And so sometimes these cases go cold because it's going to take years to find the extra money in the budget.
Is your test processing that you are going to have at this new nonprofit lab, is it going to be cheaper?
It is, because we are not going to be looking at profit margins like a for-profit company. And we have been very fortunate to have extremely highly qualified DNA consultants for whom this is a lifelong dream who are helping us with this. We're going to be able to do what I would call both types of testing. One is sort of where you can plug it into criminal databases. You might have heard of CODIS, for example.
Yeah, right.
And then the other is if you have somebody who is not in that database because they haven't committed a felony or whatever, then there's another type you may have heard of where you run it through a genealogy database.
Well, we've heard of this because of recent kind of high-profile cases, a serial killer in California. CODIS, we should say, is a database of DNA evidence, a registry, actually, of people who have committed felonies of their DNA evidence that is collected how again?
With CODIS, you do a certain type of testing. I'll just call it STR testing. And then if you get a sufficient sample, then the law enforcement agency will deem it eligible and it'll be uploaded to CODIS.
Okay.
But if, for example, like in one case that we have currently, we have a fairly strong suspect in mind, we don't believe that suspect has any criminal record. So on that one, we'll try the STR. Maybe. It depends on how big the sample is that we have to work with. But we think we're probably going to need to submit it to the genealogy website. Different type of testing.
And there's a whole conversation to be had about the sort of voluntary sharing of genetic information on genealogical websites that, well, I'm just going to save because we're low on time for this conversation. So, I mean, you're working to solve cold cases. Are you just working to solve cold cases? Can police departments submit other DNA material to you for processing at this lab?
They'll be able to. The lab has to be self-sustaining. And so it may be that we'll have to perhaps have slightly higher prices or something for what I would call warm or hot cases. I don't know yet. We have to make sure this lab is perpetually self-sustaining. But we're going to be fully certified. We're going to have people that can testify in court. We're going to be CODIS eligible. So I would hope that maybe criminal defense lawyers would use us, law enforcement would use us for non-cold cases. But everything comes down to if this is a cold case and anywhere in the country, we will do that DNA testing on a nonprofit basis.
And that, okay, and again, as you said, that would be a cheaper rate. Is there a risk that in doing this, that long-term, the state apparatus is going to say, well, charities are going to do this, if nonprofits are going to do this like yours, we don't need to do it anymore. I mean, do you have to do this forever, have this crime lab operating forever for cold cases or for any cases? Or is it just until agencies charged with doing this kind of get their ducks in a row, their work in order?
You know, I just don't see state crime labs as ever having enough funding to do what they want to do. And I suspect there's a reason that we are going to be the only nonprofit DNA lab in the country. But more and more testing is being outsourced to private labs. That's part of the problem. I mean, I know how much somebody just paid a private lab to get the profile I needed to upload it to the genealogy database. And I know what the profit margin was on that. And I am just blown away.
How crucial is it to have this evidence tested in the work that you do as the Utah Cold Case Coalition, or for anybody for that matter? I know that there's been a recent success in rape kit testing that happened here in Salt Lake City, where they required the testing of all rape kits. They have something like 100 new suspects as a result of that. How important is it for the work that you do to have the ability to run these kinds of tests?
It's essential in what we're doing to have DNA testing. I know that there is occasionally some controversy as to whether DNA testing needs to be done in 100% of alleged sexual assault cases, because I've had lawyers tell me, I don't know why they would need to test that kit. The defendant admits that he had sex with the victim, and the only issue is whether it was consensual or not. But I don't have any of those kinds of debates in what I'm doing, because I'm only working on it if the victim is dead or, you know, missing, and there may be some blood or something somewhere. Or I can tell you the saddest one was when I got a call from law enforcement out of state who has been trying to figure out who a dead child is for a long time. And he was one of the ones that said, we've been saving up and we just got enough money to have that testing done to put it into a genealogy website. That's a dead child.
Did that case get solved?
Not yet. That call was somewhat recent, and frankly, it's the thing that finally tipped us into pulling the trigger. Because it's a little bit stressful. We're doing something, once again, no one else in the country is doing. We have to arrange funding. We either have to go out and find people who are willing to loan to a nonprofit, which is not easy, as you guys may know here, or who will donate to something they don't even really have a way of understanding. Most people don't know the different types, and don't have crime labs for this, and they don't understand. We do have a, I don't know if this is permitted, we do have a GoFundMe. If you go to GoFundMe and simply type in Utah Cold Case Coalition, there is a, you know, a campaign that says nonprofit DNA testing. And, you know, every dollar we can get in through that is a dollar we don't have to go trying to find somebody that will loan to us.
Right.
We do have enough funds right now where we've signed the lease. We have the contractor starting work. You know, we're on top of all that.
How far back in time can a cold case go? I mean, earlier in this show, I talked about a murder mystery from, you know, the turn of the 20th century. What's the time frame for you, Kara?
So far, the oldest that we've been asked to look at is something from the like late 50s or early 60s, which is still within our range. As far as what can be tested, I'll just note that they're getting ready to test Leonardo da Vinci's hair.
Right, good point. Okay, how soon will you come online?
I mean, we've got the lease, and then it's construction. Then it's getting the equipment in there. But before that, we'll have the employees. We will be up and running and online before the end of the year. And of course, we have this dream of possibly getting at least part of the lab online and running by cold case month, which is August.
Okay. Kara Porter, co-founder of the Utah Cold Case Coalition, I really appreciate your coming in and talking about this with us today.
Well, thanks. I appreciate hearing about really quirky historical events in Utah. So it's been great.
Thanks, Kara. You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. Find out more about this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Please join me again next week.